discussing in the Bhagavad Gita. Oh, that's interesting. Yes, thank you. So in the Gita, then Krishna is describing prescribed duties. And what are the prescribed duties that someone should follow? So then, we wanted to take a look at prescribed duties. Well, basically, we have to see, so we approach the previous acharyas through our acharya. This is the important element. We must see things according to that. That our acharya has gone through scriptures and he has taken the essence, the principles of what the previous acharyas have said, and then presents that to us. So then when we approach the acharyas, when we approach the Vedic literatures, we have to see through the medium of our own acharya, our own spiritual master. So Srila Prabhupada has established for us very nicely the different elements that he talks about and the different culture, and gives the essence of that. And then if you want to get into detail of that, then he refers to other works. He refers to Manu, he refers to Yajnavalkya, he refers to Parasara. These are authorities on social structure. So now the prescribed duties then are coming from this. The laws of man that come from Manu, then they are the lifestyle that by following it, then one can bring one's life in line with the instructions of God. Dharma comes from God, cannot come from somewhere else. We cannot make up our own dharma. We can, but then we end up with some non-Vedic idea, which generally doesn't give us the right result. Like we see Jainism, Buddhism do not make us pure devotees of Krishna. Neither do any other system of religion that is not Vedic. Within Vedic, then we see that the principles, whether you're theist or atheist, of culture and dealings are the same. So the culture of those who follow the Vedic literature is common. At least the principles. This culture is common. It means respect for authority, approaching authority if you want to gain knowledge. All these kind of things, these are dealt with by all branches of Vedic culture. Then, with that, you have your goal. Like we want, Krishna says, we're discussing today, there's one path. Krishna says, there's only one path, there's his path. Now, you can either go up that path towards Krishna, or you can go away from Krishna. So if you follow Krishna's orders, which comes in the form of the rules and regulations of devotional service, and sadhana bhakti, as we get in Nectar Devotion, and Sanatana Goswami's teachings, you know, the deity worship that we've discussed previously, then it also is coming in these laws of the Dharma Shastra. So this is given by the Lord. You follow them, that takes you towards Krishna, because it's Krishna's rule. You don't follow them, and you're not following, let's say you don't follow a detail, because you're following a higher detail that is dealing with a higher goal, that's no problem. But you can't avoid the principle of the culture. Right? Just like mother is the first guru, she's to be respected. Then after that, there's the father, he's the second guru. Then after that, then we have the spiritual guru. So there may be in detail, we may not follow the principles or direction of the father, just like we see Prahlad Maharaj didn't follow his father's instructions on the goal of life. He followed the orders of his spiritual master, Narad Muni. But we see it, he did not misbehave. He still followed the culture. He still would, eulogize his father, oh, best among the demons, you know, like this. He would deal with him very nicely, speak very gently. He wouldn't complain, you know. You know, he's supposed to go to the school. His father sent him to the school. Like that. He just, the conclusions he doesn't like. But that he takes the conclusions given by his acharya. So the culture remains. If there's differences in opinion, that's one thing. In the philosophy. But the culture is always there. So you can't leave the culture. You can't disrespect authority because you're following a higher authority, you disrespect a lower authority. No. You have to respect authority. That's the principle. But just whether their instructions are valid for attaining the goal of life, that may be finessed. That is, so we must be able to see the difference between a difference in philosophy and following of the culture. So the culture always remains. You must still be civil. Right? It doesn't matter what the situation is. Amongst civilized persons, if they're having a discussion and there's a difference of opinion, they expect you still to be civil. You don't yell and scream and bang your shoes on the table and, you know, throw things across the room because somebody on the other side you didn't like what they said. It's just considered bad manners. You may have your opinion, it may be different, you can express it. There's a forum for that, but you still have to behave properly. So this developing this culture, that is very important. So the topmost culture is the natural culture that springs from the spontaneous love for the Lord. Krishna says if you can't surrender to that, then surrender to the culture that was given to us according to the Pancharatric scriptures. Follow the process of sadhana bhakti, the pancharatra, and the aspects of bhakti that connect with that. You know, the rules and regulations, so the karma, the jnana, these aspects that connect with devotion, that help us become elevated. How do you say? Work as assistance to bhakti, just like taking our morning bath. Taking 3 times bath a day does not make us into a devotee. But by taking 3 times bath a day, we are very clean, and it's Krishna's order. Therefore, we become purified. We become freed from our conditioned nature, and that helps us surrender to Krishna. It brings us closer to that ultimate final surrendering to Krishna. We follow the sadhana to get to that position of surrender. Krishna says, if you can't do that, that doesn't fully engage you, then you work for him. This brings in culture, varnashram. So this means then the Dharma Shastras and all the different culture that's there enumerated in the Puranas, Upapuranas, that supports sadhana. And sadhana is for the purpose of fully surrendering to the Lord. So it's one process, it's one path. So Krishna says it's one path, it's one path. It's just that if you make your goal the heavenly planets, you're called a karma. You're a karmi. If you make your goal the Brahman, you're a jnani. If your goal is also merging in the Lord or Siddhi, you're called a yogi. Right? And depending on what you're doing, you're a hatha yogi, you're a raja yogi, you're all these different things. It's still on Krishna's path. So now if it's one path, that means you have karma, jnana, and yoga on this path. Now, if you take that as a goal, then you're called by that. If you take the whole path leading to Krishna, that's called a bhakti yogi. So he sees, I have a material body. I have to follow the rules and regulations that are given in the scriptures that are enjoined in relationship to this body. Then we become advanced. We become purified. Then the devotional understanding is easy to gain, easy to relate to, because we're purified. So if following Krishna's rules, we come to that platform. Does this make any sense? Because if that's understood, then the conversations, how we're going to approach this, will make some sense. Means the Dharma Shastra is one portion of the path. Means the original thing is always remember Krishna, never forget. And since we're not remembering Krishna, we have to have a process by which to remember. And because we're always forgetting Krishna because of being distracted in the material world, there must be a process how we can extricate ourselves from that attachment. So then that naturally comes down as sadhanas, comes down as the Dharma Shastras. And this makes for us a complete process. So if you take Dharma Shastra on their own, and that's it, then you're a karmi. If you take Dharma Shastra in relationship to sadhana and full surrender to Krishna, then you're a bhakti yogi. So this is, it depends how you see it. We take a potato, right? Everybody on the planet is taking potatoes. Now we take this potato and we cook it for Krishna. We still use the same principles of cooking. We use knives, we use pots, we used oil, we use spoons, we used a fire. Now, if I don't understand the whole process, the devotional process, I'll say, well, what's the difference? All the karmis are cooking, so this is karmi nonsense. That's because I don't understand how you can cook for Krishna. If we understand how to cook for Krishna, then we understand this is how the process is going to go through. I'm going to go through the same, it looks exactly the same as a karmi. He goes to the market to buy his potatoes, I go to the market to buy the potatoes. He plunks down some money and gets the potatoes, and gets the potatoes in exchange for the money, I'm doing that. He gets in a vehicle, goes back to his place, I get in a vehicle. He walks to his house, I walk. He goes into his kitchen, I go into the kitchen. He washes and cuts the vegetables, I wash and cut them. He puts them in a pot, I put them in a pot. He turns on the fire and cooks them, I do the same thing. He then after cooking it, puts it on his plate and eats it. So that's where he ends. So that's all the farther he got on the path. But I now take it, put it on a plate, offer it to Krishna, wash Krishna's plate, then after, honor the prasad. Therefore, I followed the process of cooking and got to Krishna. The other person followed the process of cooking and went to hell. So they're on the same path, but the devotee in his cooking is going towards Krishna, the karmi in his cooking is going away from Krishna. But it's the same principles. So social structure, social relationships is only one set of principles. You're nice to people, they like you. You're not nice to people, they don't like you. You want to be in a position of authority or lead, you have to give shelter. You don't do it, you will not be in that position. No one will appreciate. You're going to follow someone, you have to be submissive. If you don't want to be submissive, no one will accept you as a follower. These are principles, anywhere, from the aboriginal culture up to the topmost culture. They're just there. You can't avoid them. Fire is hot for the devotee, fire is hot for the karmi. Water is wet for the devotee, it's wet for the karmi. Material energy is material energy. It's controlled by the three modes. Now, our choice is whether we want to be under yoga maya in moving this material energy because we connected to Krishna, or we want to be under mahamaya because we refuse to connect it to Krishna. That is our choice. Right? So if we understand these points, and the purpose is to bring it to the devotional platform, then one can understand prescribed duties. Otherwise, one cannot understand. Can't understand. How you'll understand? Because the duties have come from Krishna. So you'll never fully understand the duties unless you understand Krishna. This is the point. You see it in relationship to Krishna, it's perfect. Okay, now, I think we discussed before. No, we discussed it means, yeah, we discussed paravidya, paravidya, right? Didn't we discuss that yesterday? That was with you. Okay. So now you have three kinds of knowledge. You have paravidya, which means transcendental knowledge. And that is the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. You know, that is your Upanishads, that is your Vedanta, and this is like Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, Chaitanya Charitamrita. These are paravidya, transcendental knowledge. And any books written in pursuance of these, that is transcendental knowledge. Then, you have another branch. You have another category of knowledge. That's called aparavidya, which means material knowledge that is in relationship to Krishna. So that means you take your Sanskrit, your astrology, your rituals, your Dharma Shastras, your histories, your logic, you know, the Vedic literature itself, because it's dealing with the material energy. But it's dealing with the material energy in its relationship to Krishna. Right? So that's called aparavidya. You become purified by that, elevated by that. You don't develop devotion, but you're elevated by that. You become freed from material contamination. Right? And because it's engaged in the Lord's service, it carries that bhakti with it. And that bhakti that's there, inherent in the work, that purifies the heart. Right? And the thing itself freezes from the contamination. Two things are going on at once. We're having to develop our love for Krishna, and we're having to detach yourself from Maya. Right? So attracted to Krishna and detached from Maya. So these different, the aparavidya helps us become detached from Maya. And the paravidya attaches us to Krishna. Right? And the aparavidya shows us how to work within the material world. And it gives us the knowledge by which we can perform, we can work with the aparavidya. Is as we're conditioned, we need to work with, we are going to work with the material energy. Kanista, by definition, is called Prakriti Bhakta. Means he deals with Prakriti. He has material desire. And conditioned soul means he's conditioned to material nature. He's conditioned to karma, jnana, and yoga. So that's what we know. Therefore, Krishna comes to us in devotional service in that form that we can relate to, in the form, seeming form of karma, jnana, and yoga. So we engage activities, our activities, karma, in Krishna's service, with knowledge about the material world and our the material nature, our relationship with Krishna, who we are, and that's called sambandha. Right? And yoga, we try to make this connection where we're always remembering the Lord and always absorbed in chanting the Lord's name. So you combine that together, it's a perfect combination. You know? Prabhupada translates in the Gita, karma yoga, action in Krishna consciousness. Right? This is the fifth chapter. So when you're doing activities in Krishna consciousness, in the how you say it? Conditioned state, that's karma yoga. But because it's connected with Krishna, it's called it's action in Krishna consciousness. It's different from karma. Karma means I want the fruit. Karma means activity. So that activity which gives the fruit is just called karma. And the fruit is ours. That activity that we do and that fruit is for Krishna, that's called karma yoga. By our karma, we link with Krishna. So this becomes very, very, very nice, very important. So now, that's the aparavidya. So all the aparavidyas, all the Vedic knowledge, other than the philosophy, that is all connected to the paravidya. It all starts generally with the spiritual and comes down. Then it comes down to the platform of what you're dealing with. Right, just like in the Harinamrita Vyakaran. The first text is the aksharas of Narayanad Udbhuto Yam Varna Kramaha. That the varnas, the letters, they have come from Narayan. Right? So it starts there. Its beginning starts with Narayan and shows how from Narayan have expanded the Sanskrit syllables. Like that. Then it gets into the grammar. Once you've come from Narayan to the syllables, then, okay, now we deal with it as grammar. So same. You're dealing with the rituals of deity worship. You start with the Lord in the spiritual realm, right? Paravyoma, right? And then you come down and it shows all the stages till you get to the Archamurti. Right? The Archamurti is what we can see in the material world. Right? But it starts in the spiritual realm. So like this, all the branches of knowledge start from that. We see the Bhagavatam starts with Krishna's creation. Krishna's creation. Then it goes into Brahma's creation, right? Then it goes into the Prajapatis. Then it goes into the Manus. Then it goes into the kings. So you have those things. It's called the Purana, right? Purana, by definition, at least the Pancha Lakshana, must have creation, means God's creation. Recreation, dissolution, that's Brahma's creation. It must have the histories of the Prajapatis. Must have the histories of the Manus and histories of the kings of the Sun and Moon dynasty. Plus, the Mahapurana then has five more because it deals with spiritual subject matter. Summum Bonum and all these different things. So we see the Bhagavatam has those. But it starts, Krishna comes down. So like that, then all these things do that. So here, the laws of Manu also do the same thing. First, they start with the creation. Then when it comes down to the point where it gets to the people, then from there it gets into the rules. So each of the scriptures, Ayurveda, everything, they all show where it connects to Krishna. What is the connection? So someone has studied in it, he understands that this whole science is connected to God. But we're dealing with this aspect of God's manifestation. God has expanded the material world. He's established the material world. And I can look at different angles of it and different aspects of it. But I should know how that aspect originated in God. Then it becomes aparavidya. Now, if you take the same material knowledge and don't connect it to Krishna, it's called avidya, or ignorance. And by studying that knowledge, and by practicing that knowledge, you go away from Krishna. So by studying aparavidya, you go towards Krishna, and avidya, you go away from Krishna. Though it's the same knowledge. Right? Just like the knife can be used for surgical operations or cutting vegetables, or it can be used in mischievous ways. Money can be used for Krishna, it can be used for Maya. The same thing. So in the same way as the knowledge, if it's used for Krishna, it's called aparavidya. It's used with not in relationship to Krishna, it's called avidya. So the aparavidya studied in relationship to paravidya, then you know the material and spiritual. Vidyam cha yas tad vedo bahyagam. That one should study the knowledge and what's knowledge and what is not knowledge side by side. It also should be known in the Upanishads, since it's meant for renunciates, even the aparavidya is considered avidya. So you have transcendental knowledge and then you have everything else. Like that. So, in other words, the material knowledge and the spiritual must be studied side by side. But you have to see the material in relationship to the spiritual. Then it becomes perfect. Otherwise, useless. Right? We see many people have studied Sanskrit. Some of them have become very nice devotees. And some of them have gone away from Krishna consciousness, thinking they have found, okay, now Sanskrit, and they've gone into higher realms of study, like that, because they could not see the connection of Sanskrit to the transcendental knowledge. Therefore, it takes them away from Krishna. You see that any branch of knowledge or any activity. If you connect it to Krishna, it brings you closer. You don't connect it to Krishna, it takes you away. It's that simple. So that's the difference between aparavidya and avidya. Aparavidya is always in connection with the paravidya, the transcendental knowledge, with the purpose of gaining that knowledge, in support of that knowledge, and avidya means it doesn't consider the transcendental, it doesn't compare them. All right. Is this clear? Okay. So then, here are the laws of mana. One will have to excuse the archaic translations. Yeah. Also, it should be understood that what we're reading here, sometimes the translators aren't, not knowing the scriptures very well, sometimes mistranslate. Yes.
They're like modern science. What type of knowledge is that?
Modern science. Yeah. That if you cannot connect it to Krishna, then it's avidya. It's ignorance. Because by studying it, it will take you away from God. Like you see, many scientists, they study it because they're trying to work out the universe, and they figure they're God themselves. There's no God. Right? There's no God in control. There's just lust. Right? You'll find scientists, if you ever worked with them or known them, they're a very debauched group of people like that, because everything's just chemicals, so what does it matter what the chemicals do? Right? There's no standard. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But you will find that as many scientists, by studying the material world, have understood there must be somebody behind this. It's so orderly and so perfect, there must be a God. So then that becomes, that's more in line. That's in line with, you understand? Like that. Yeah. So that's the whole point. You can use material knowledge to go towards Krishna or away from Krishna.
But at some point, the scientists would have to come in contact with Vedic knowledge to actually make that.
Yeah, to sense. Means because the Vedic deals with higher. Your material knowledge, especially your science, is only dealing with the material elements. So it's a platform of anamoy. It's only sensual knowledge. You may use the intelligence, but the sphere in which you're dealing is sensual knowledge, nothing else. They're not dealing something else. A jnani is using his intelligence, but he's using it in the realm of intelligence. The soul and the knowledge and the like this, and trying to understand the workings of the material world. He's working on a higher platform. When you're just working on how the material energy just functions within itself, on itself, that's anamoy. But when I see how material nature is working on me, what is my relationship in it? How there's the, you know, supreme knowledge, you know, or at least I understand the glimmer of the twilight of spiritual knowledge. I understand Brahman. That's the intellectual platform. Then when I add into that the Supreme Lord and my relationship there, then it becomes spiritual, fully spiritual. Then it becomes anandamai. So the intelligence can be used to establish one on any of the five levels. Right, you know, and yeah, but yeah, okay. The great sages approached Manu, who was seated with a collected mind, and having duly worshipped him, spoke as follows: Divine One, please declare to us, precisely and in due order, the sacred laws of each of the four chief varnas and ashrams. For you alone knowest the purport, in other words, the rights and knowledge of the soul, taught in this whole ordinance of self-existence, Swayambhu, which is unknowable and unfathomable. So they've approached Manu here. And we see that he is sitting with collected mind. Means he is very peaceful. He is properly trained. Your mind is only going to be collected if you are properly trained. So he has been trained. And we see that they are approaching very nicely the principles of Tadviri Pratipatena, Pariprashna. And they worship Seva. So they want to know, they're submissive, and they render service. So we see the culture here is perfect. Then he says, for you only know the purport. Means that they're not so worried about the rule itself. The rule, we must know the rule. But the rule without the purport, what's the use? Like we see, when Arjuna or anyone would ask for a weapon, they would ask for the weapon with knowledge of its use and the mantras and everything about it. If you just say, give me the weapon, someone will give you the weapon. Okay. But you don't know how to use it? So they say, give me the weapon with all of the knowledge of how to use it and the ability to use it. So here they're asking, you alone know the purport. So that's what they want. Give us the rule. That's, you know, we have to know how to behave. But give us the purport. What is the purpose? And why is it? Because you know the rites and you know the philosophy of the soul. You know the transcendental. So you know the aparavidya, which is what we're asking you about, and you know the purport, which is the paravidya. Therefore, they're approaching him. Right? Yeah. This whole ordinance of the self-existent. Yeah. He whose power is measureless, being thus... Oh, okay. Being thus asked by the high-minded sages, duly honored them and answered, listen. So now he honors them. They have come, but he also honors them. Because here, they are high-minded great saints. High-minded means, didn't say proud. High-minded means mind is interested in very lofty topics. They're interested in the transcendental. So therefore, now they've approached him. And he respects that. They've respected him as knowing this, but he has to respect them as also being worthy candidates. So the teacher is also respecting the student. So many of the rituals you'll see when going to the Gurukul, when in the ceremony of entering the Gurukul, then the teacher, the acharya, he circumambulates the student. Right? Because here is a good student. A good student is worshipable. And when the student finishes the education and he's graduating to leave, then the same teacher is also then respecting him, worshiping him, washing his feet. The teacher washes the feet of the student on his leaving and worships him with paraphernalia. Because now he is a trained person. He is a man fit to go and lead the society. That person is respectable. So even the teacher respects him. So that aspect is there. But we see there, he's respecting here, he's respecting the beginning, he's respecting at the end. And in the middle, he's always dealing, because a valuable student means one who can gain knowledge, one who has the proper character, is respectable. But the culture is there. So that will be very subtle, you know, very gentle, while the respect of the junior for the senior is generally more the external and seen respect. It's just the relationship. So this is that. And then he says, listen. You know, means I will speak. So this is Shabda. So Shabda is the best of all knowledge. They've gone there for Shabda, and now he's saying, you listen. So now Manu speaks. This universe existed in the shape of darkness, unperceived, destitute of distinctive marks, unattainable by reasoning, unknowable, wholly immersed, as it were, in deep sleep. So we first have the pradhan. And this pradhan then is unknowable, you know, by intelligence. Because it's beyond intelligence. Intelligence hasn't been created. So only after creation, then you can understand what's going on here. So pradhan is before that. So it can't be understood. Then the divine self-existent, Swayambhu himself, indiscernible, but making all this, the great elements of the rest, discernible, appeared with irresistible creative power, dispelling the darkness. So this is then the Lord, he divided it up. Right? The first creation is Krishna's, creates the elements. Brahma can't do. We have to understand Swayambhu, there's different aspects of it. Swayambhu is the creative potency. Like that, the creative desire. So Krishna, Mahavishnu, he has basically three mentalities. That of the creator, which is Swayambhu or Hiranyagarbha. That of the maintainer, that's Vishnu. and that of the destroyer, that's Shambhu or Sadashiv. So then that comes into the material. Then the next that comes down, Krishna breaks it up. Then you have Brahma, who is the creator. Then you have Swayambhuva Manu, who is the creator of mankind. So this element of creation, that is coming from Krishna. So in this, because they use the word Swayambhu, therefore, then the non-devotee will accept this scripture. If it only talks about directly about Krishna, then the atheist will not be interested in the scripture. And then he won't follow God's rules. So he'll only be sinful, go to hell. So here, they use Swayambhu because then, depending upon what is your level, I just see Dharma Shastra. I see Swayambhuva Manu. I see beyond that, I see Brahma. I see beyond that, I see Mahavishnu. Or Garbhodakshay Vishnu. Kiranodakshay Vishnu. So like that, I can see whatever level I want, depending upon what I get. But at least I'll follow the Lord's order. He who can be perceived by the internal organ, which is the mind, who is subtle, indiscernible, and external, eternal, who contains all created beings and is inconceivable, shown forth of his own will. He desired to produce things of many kinds from his own body, first with a thought, created their waters and placed his seed in them. So the Garbhodak ocean was first created. That seed became a golden egg. Oh no, here we're talking about the Karanodak ocean. That seed became a golden egg, in brilliancy equal to the sun. In that egg, he himself was born as Brahman, the progenitor of the whole world. So then Garbhodakshay Vishnu comes. The waters are called Nara, for the waters are indeed the offspring of Nara, as they were his first residence, Ayana. He is hence named Narayana. Yeah. Okay, so that water is that, and that's where the Lord stays in the water. Karanodakshay Vishnu stays in the water, the Karanodak ocean. Garbhodakshay stays in the Garbhodak ocean. Kirodakshay Vishnu stays in the Kir ocean. So therefore he's known as Narayana, because the water is his first residence. From that first cause, which is indiscernible, eternal, and both real and unreal, was produced that male Purusha, who is famed in this world, under the appellation of Brahman. So he's the Purusha. So now we're getting, basically we see now it's following what the Purusha Shukta describes, because the first hymn in all the four Vedas is the Purusha Shukta. You have the Hare Krishna mantra, that expands into the Gayatris, Kama Gayatri, that expands into the other Gayatris and their seed syllables. Then when we cross into the material world, Om comes through first, because it's the last. Then Om comes through, and then from that comes Burbhuvaswa, comes the Gayatri, comes the Purusha Shukta. And then the Vedas expand from there. So the explanation of the Purusha Shukta, that describes all the creation, like that. There's also a chapter in the Bhagavatam that describes Purusha Shukta confirmed. The Divine One resided in that egg during a whole year. Then he himself, by his thought alone, divided it into two halves. Out of those two halves, he formed heaven and earth. Between them, the middle sphere, that's Bhur Bhuva Swa. Bhur is the earth, Bhuvar is the space in between, Swa is the heavenly planets, or the upper planets. The eight points of the horizon, and the eternal abode of the waters. So you have the spheres, and you have the directions. Because without direction, there's no activity. Without space and direction, then there's no movement, there's no activity. From himself, he also drew forth the mind, which is both real and unreal. Likewise, from the mind, egoism, which possessed the function of self-consciousness and is lordy. Moreover, the Great One, the soul, and all products affected by the three qualities, and in their order, the five organs which perceive the objects of sensation. But joining minute particles, even of those six, which possesses measureless power, with particles of himself, he created all beings. So then he entered, he's created all the elements. Now he enters in between, in every atom and between every atom, and that forms all the, creates all the forms and bodies and everything we see. Everything is coming, because he's entered between them, so everything's held together by Krishna. Because those six kinds of minute particles, which form the Creator's frame, enter these creatures. Therefore, the wise call his frame Sharir, the body. Oh, I see. Ashri. So that becomes Sharir. That great elements enter together with their functions in the mind through its minute parts, the framer of all beings, the imperceptible one. So the elements are coming from the Lord, the elements enter the Lord. So we see that all this is being described, same as in the Bhagavatam. But from minute body framing, particles of these seven very powerful Purushas, springs this world, the perishable, from the imperishable. Among them, each succeeding element acquires the quality of the preceding one, and whatever place in the sequence each one of them occupies, even so many qualities it is declared to possess. So the elements come down from the ether, then you get the sense of hearing, and the sense and the ears. Then from that you comes that then that creates the air. Air is touch, and the skin, and then each one like comes down like this. All the five elements they come down. So everything's coming out of you. Originally started with the pradhan. Then that's broken up, and then you get the ego, from that comes the intelligence, the mind, all these different things, they all come down. But in the beginning he assigned the several names, actions and conditions to all created beings, even according to the words of the Veda. He, the Lord, also created the class of the gods, which are endowed with life, and whose nature is action, and the settled class of the sadhyas and the eternal sacrifice. From fire, wind, and sun he drew forth the threefold eternal Veda, called Rik, Yajus, and Saman, for the due performance of the sacrifice. Time and divisions of time, the lunar mansions and the planets, the rivers, the oceans, the mountains, plains, and uneven ground. Austerity, speech, pleasure, desire, anger, this whole creation he likewise produced, as he desired to call these beings into existence. Moreover, in order to distinguish actions, he separated merit from demerit, and he caused the creatures to be affected by pairs of opposites, such as pain and pleasure. So now we see that we're getting down, now we're getting into the realm of the topic of the book. Because he's created all these different things. He's come down all the elements, then he's created the higher beings, the middle beings, the process of sacrifice, time, all these divisions, all the planets, all the rivers, ocean, everything, down to the minute things. Then he gets into the finer things, austerity, speech, pleasure, desire, all these different things, which are the emotions and way one's going to act. Then merit and demerit. So now at this point, when you get there, this is the point on which we see now it branches now specifically into Dharma Shastra. So we can see here the flow. It started from Karano Dakshai Vishnu, came to Garbho Dakshai Vishnu. He created all the elements and then expanded that. As Kira Dakshai Vishnu, he enters into everything. Then he creates all the manifestations of it. And then he creates all the values and all the different elements of our experiences. And in that, he creates what's good and what's bad. So that brings us now to the point of the Dharma Shastra. So that's the connection. And all the scriptures, they all start like that. All the Vedic literatures and that, they always start with the Lord and come down. Like that. But with the minute perishable particles of the five elements, which have been mentioned, this whole world is framed in due order. But to whatever course of action the Lord has first appointed each, that alone it has spontaneously adopted in each succeeding creation. Means this creation, the next creation, it's all the same. Means the living entities in this, a dog in this creation, acts the same as the dog in the last creation, will act the same as the dog in the next creation. Like that. So Krishna has created this. So therefore we can understand these principles are always being followed. It wasn't just something made up just for this universe or for a particular time. It's made up for all time. It means anyone in the material world, this knowledge is always there. That knowledge is always present. The Dharma Shastras are based on, the Vedas are called apurusheya, means unspoken. They weren't written. They're shruti. Now in them they have four parts. That is the Samhita itself, this the verses of the Veda. Then the Brahmanas, which are how to use those in sacrifice. Then you have the Aranyakas, which are for the purpose, what is the purpose behind those sacrifices and what are the goals like that. And then the Upanishads, which gives the ultimate goal, or the transcendental knowledge, like that. So taking from the Brahmanas, then that is where your Dharma Shastras come down. So they're based on this aspect of the Veda. Therefore, it's considered one of the branches of Vedic knowledge. Whatever he assigned to each at the first creation, noxiousness or harmlessness, gentleness or ferocity, yeah, virtue or sin, truth or falsehood, that clung afterwards spontaneously to it. So when Krishna created things, what was the nature of that that remains in the creation? It means those bodies, we see as he created sharir, those bodies and the nature that goes with those bodies, those remain. You know, the mango tree always gives mangoes in its particular season. It always looks the same. Coconut tree gives coconuts. Looks different, but all the coconut trees look the same. Like this, it's been established. In other words, it's God's rule. So we can't say, well, I'm different, I'm unique. You know, we're not from India, we're from the West. We're different. But yes, that's true. God has assigned the nature of malechas and yavanas, and you can't get around that. So if you want to go on behaving like a malecha and yavana, yes, that'll happen, without even our endeavor. But if we want to become human, then we must follow the rules that go with human life, which Manu will speak. Otherwise, yes, we will remain with the same nature that has been given to us. Malechas, at the beginning creation, we're doing the same thing. There's no difference. Like that, 151 trillion years ago, they were still the same, malechas. And today, they're still the same. So it's not that it's something new and unique. Malechas have been there for, you know, a long time. Like that. They've always been there. Just sometimes they're more manifest and more prominent, and sometimes they're less. So the whole process of the Dharma Shastra is to take one from a Malecha and Yavana and bring us to the platform of human. As at the change of seasons. Okay. So now he gets into the definitions of the living entity. As at the change of seasons, each season of its own accord assumes its distinctive marks, even so corporal beings resume in new births their appointed course of action. Means the seasons just go through their natural sequence. So the living entity, in performing karma, just goes through a natural sequence also. If you're bad, slowly you become good. When you're good, slowly you become bad. So it's just going from one to the other. It's just happening like seasons. So in the samsara, sometimes someone's on the top, but with time they're on the bottom, with time they're on the top, like that. It's just happening. It's just going around. So the whole point of this is to show that it's happening. So now it's a matter of us making the conscious choice to step out of this just being pushed by the modes of nature and now take up an actual determination to serve the Supreme Lord. And doing that, I mean, purifying the conditioned nature by following Krishna's rules. But for the sake of prosperity of the worlds, he caused the Brahmana, the Kshatriya, the Vaishya, and the Shudra to proceed from his mouth, his arms, his thighs, and his feet. Dividing his own body, the Lord became half male and half female. With that female, he produced Virag. But no... But know me, O most holy among the twice born, to be creator of this world, whom that male Virag himself produced, having performed austerities. Then I desiring to produce creating beings, perform very difficult austerities, and thereby called into existence 10 great sages, lords of created beings. Marichi, Atri, Angira, Pulastya, Pulaha, Kratu, Praketas, Vashishta, Bhrigu, and Narad. They created 7 other Manus, possessing great brilliancy, gods and classes of gods, and great measures of immeasurable power. So this must be here Brahma speaking. The Lord Brahma here. Seems that this is the, when the Swayambhu here, they've approached Lord Brahma. The Yakshas, servants of Kuvera, the demons, Rakshasas, Pisachas, Gandharvas, Apsaras, Asuras, Nagas, Sarpas, Suparnas, which are, seem to be forms of birds, and several classes of the manes. Lightning, thunderbolts, clouds, imperfect and perfect rainbows, falling meteors, supernatural noises, comets, heavenly lights of many kinds. Horse-faced kinaras, monkeys, fishes, birds of many kinds, cattle, deer, men, and carnivorous beasts with 2 rows of teeth. Small and large worms, beetles, moths, lice, flies, bugs, all stinging and biting insects, and the several kinds of immovable things. Thus was this whole creation, both the immovable and movable, produced by those high-minded ones by means of austerities and at my command, each being according to the result of its actions. So these Prajapatis, then they established all these different living entities. But whatever act is stated to belong to each of those creatures here, below, that I will truly declare to you, as well as their order in respect to birth. Cattle, deer, carnivorous beasts with 2 rows of teeth, rakshasas, pisachas, and men are born from the womb. From eggs are born birds, snakes, crocodiles, fish, tortoises, as well as similar terrestrial and aquatic animals. From hot moisture spring stinging and biting insects, lice, flies, bugs, and all other creatures of that kind which are produced by heat. All plants propagated by seed or by slips grown from shoots, annual plants, are those which bearing many flowers and fruits perish after the ripening of their fruit. Those trees which bear fruit without flowers are called vanaspati, lords of the forest, but those which bear both flowers and fruits are called vriksha. But the various plants with many stalks growing from one or several roots, the different kinds of grasses, the climbing plants, and the creepers spring from seed, all from seed or from slips. These plants, which are surrounded by multiform darkness, the results of their acts in former existences, possess internal consciousness and experience pleasure and pain. So it's saying that they're surrounded by multiple darkness because they were sinful or impious, therefore they ended up as trees and plants. But internally they have consciousness and they do experience pleasure and pain. It's very small, but they do experience. The various conditions in this... okay, now we'll get into... So that was all the living entities created by the Prajapatis. Now we'll get into the Manus themselves. The various conditions in this way, in this always terrible and constantly changing cycle of birth and death, to which created beings are subjected, are stated to begin with that of Brahman and to end with that of these just mentioned immovable creatures. So he's saying it starts from God and it comes down to these plants. So they're the bottom. Right? God is the top, the supreme conscious. Then you come down to the higher living entities who are very conscious, like the Prajapatis and other high-minded Brahmins like this, the residents of the higher planets. Then coming down to the bottom, you get down to the plants, whose conscious is very low. So they're all coming from the supreme, and but that is the end of the line. When he whose power is incomprehensible had thus produced the universe and me. Yes, so this is Brahma speaking. He disappeared in himself, repeatedly suppressing one period by means of the other. When that Divine One wakes, then this world stirs. When he slumbers tranquilly, then the universe sinks to sleep. But when he reposes in calm sleep, the corporal beings whose nature is action desist from their action and minds become inert. So this is the disillusions. When they are absorbed all at once in that great soul, then he who is the soul of all beings sweetly slumbers, free from all care and occupation. When this soul has entered darkness, it remains for a long time united with the organs of sensation, but performs not its functions. It then leaves the corporal frame. Then, being clothed with minute particles only, it enters into vegetable or animal seed. So now it's talking about when the soul leaves the body also. Then, being clothed in minute particles only, it enters into vegetable or animal seed. It then assumes, united with the fine body, a new corporal frame. So the process of transmigration of the soul from one material body to the other. Thus he, the imperishable one, by alternatively waking and slumbering, incessantly revives and destroys this whole movable and immovable creation. But he, having composed these institutes of the sacred law himself, taught them according to the rule to me alone in the beginning. Next, I taught them to Marichi and the other sages. So here he's saying that Krishna, the institutes of sacred law, or the laws of mankind, how they should behave, how everybody behave, that was created by Krishna. He's composed this. Then he taught that to Brahma. Brahma taught that to the Prajapatis. Bhrigu here will fully recite to you these institutes, for that sage learned the whole in its entirety from me. Then that great sage Bhrigu, being thus addressed by Manu, spoke, pleased in his heart, to all the sages, "Listen." Six other high-minded, very powerful Manus, who belong to the race of this Manu, the descendant of the self-existent Swayambhu, and who have severally produced created beings, are Swarokisha, Otami, Tamasa, Raivata, Kaushusha, possessing great luster and the son of Vivasvat. These seven very glorious Manus, the first whom among them is Swayambhuva, produced and protected this whole movable and immovable creation, each during the period allotted to them. 18 nimishas, twinklings of the eye, are one kasha. It's interesting. Nimisha is how much time it takes to blink your eye. So that's one of the measurements. You get down to the lower, the nimisha. 30 kashtas, one kala. 30 kalas, one muhurta. And as many muhurtas, 30 kalas, as one muhurta and 30 muhurtas make one day and night. 8. The sun divides days and nights, both human and divine, the night being intended for the repose of created beings, and the day for exertion. A month is a day and a night of the mains. So that means the pakshas, the waxing and waning of the sun, that is for the forefathers, like that, the pitris. For them, that is one day. The dark fortnight is their day for active exertion. The bright fortnight, their night for sleep. A year is a day and a night of the gods. Their division is as follows. The half year during which the sun progresses to the north will be the day. That during which it goes southwards, the night. So now we're still in the night of the demigods. Like that, until January. But now here, the brief description of the duration of a day and night of Brahman, and of the several ages of the world, Yuga, according to their order. They declare that the Krita age consists of 4,000 years of the gods. And this is the Krita age, is the Satya Yuga. 4,000 years of the gods. So that means you take one of our years, times 365, times 1,000, times 4,000, then you get Satya Yuga. The twilight preceding it consists of as many hundreds, and the twilight following it of the same number. Means 400. So you hear, this is the Yuga Sandhyas. So here the Yuga Sandhyas, there's 400 years of the demigods is the Sandhya between Satya and Treta, like this. In the other three ages, with their twilights preceding and following, the thousands and hundreds are diminished by one in each. So that means 4,000, 3,000, 2,000, 1,000. So the Sandhyas are also 400, 300, 200, 100. These 12,000 years, which thus have been mentioned as the total of four human ages, are called one age of the gods. So we have the four yugas, that's one for the demigods. But know that the sum of 1,000 ages of the gods makes one day of Brahman, and that has his night has the same length. Those only who know that the holy day of Brahman indeed ends after the completion of 1,000 ages of the gods, and that his night lasts as long, are really men acquainted with the length of days and nights. At the end of that day and night, he who is asleep awakes, and after awakening, creates mind, which is both real and unreal. Mind impelled by Brahman's desire to create, performs the work of creation. By modifying itself, hence ether is produced. They declare that sound is the quality of the latter. But from ether modifying itself springs the pure, powerful wind, the vehicle of all perfumes, that is held to possess the quality of touch. Next, from the wind modifying itself, proceeds the brilliant light, which illuminates and dispels darkness, that is declared to possess the quality of color. And from light modifying itself, it produced water, possessing the quality of taste. From water, earth, which has the quality of smell, such as the creation in the beginning. The before-mentioned age of the gods, or 12,000 of their years, being multiplied by 71, constitutes that is here named the period of Amanu, Manvantar. The Manvantars, the creations and destructions of the world, are numberless. Sporting as it were, Brahman repeats this again and again. In the Krita age, Dharma is four-footed and entire, and so is truth. Nor does any gain accrue to men by unrighteousness. In the other three ages, by reason of unjust gains, agama, dharma is deprived successfully of one foot, and through the prevalence of theft, falsehood, and fraud, the merit gained by men is diminished by one-fourth in each. You know, so the Bhagavatam describes this, that you have all four principles of religion in the first day, in Satya Yuga, then you have three in the Treta, two in the Dwapara, one in the Kali. So all that's left is a little bit of truth, and even that is shaky. Men are free from disease, accomplish all their aims, and live 400 years in the Krita age. But in the Treta, and in each of the succeeding ages, their life is lessened by one quarter. The life of mortals, mentioned in the Veda, the desired results of sacrificial rites, and the supernatural power of embodied spirits are fruits proportioned among men according to the character of the age. Yeah. One set of duties is prescribed for men in the Krita age, different ones in the Treta, and in the Dwarpara, and again another set in the Kali, in proportion as those ages decrease in length. In the Krita age, the chief virtue is declared to be the performance of austerities, in the Treta, divine knowledge, in the Dwapara, the performance of sacrifices, and in Kali, liberality alone. But in order to protect this universe, he, the most resplendent one, assigned separate duties and occupations to those who sprang from his mouth, arms, thighs, and feet. To Brahmanas he assigned teaching and studying the Veda, sacrificing for their own benefit and for others, giving and accepting alms. The Kshatriyas he commanded to protect the people, to bestow gifts, to offer sacrifices, to study the Veda, and to abstain from attaching himself to sensual pleasures. The Vaishya to tend cattle, to bestow gifts to other sacrifices, to offer sacrifices, to study the Veda, to trade, to lend money, and to cultivate land. One occupation alone, only, the Lord prescribed to the Shudra, to serve meekly even these other three castes. Man is stated to be purer above the navel than below. Hence the self-existent Swayambhu has declared the purest part of him to be his mouth. So as we see as this is going, that is following the same, it's describing exactly the same things that we hear in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So this is the Vedic knowledge. It follows this course. So now as we're starting to, let's see, So the principle that we're seeing here is that what is saying is the same. So it's natural it's going to carry on and give the same viewpoint on the activities that one should perform. Difference being is it will be giving that the purpose of all this we can see is to understand and know the Supreme Lord. Brahma's been talking about the Supreme Lord. Bhrigu is talking about the Supreme Lord. So that means the activities are for the dharmic activities are for the purpose of pleasing the Supreme Lord. They're followed with that purpose, they become useful in devotional service. If they're not followed in relationship to Krishna, they become useless. That's a very important point. But we can see that the Vedic knowledge is actually consistent. We just have to have a standard by which to judge it and how to see it. In other words, when we see it through the eyes of our acharya, then it becomes consistent. If we don't see it that way, then we will see it may be contradictory, it may not. Any questions on this up to now? If not, then we have another 2 pages, we'll finish this chapter. Because this is basically just dealing with the creation. After this, it'll get more into the rule, into the laws. As the Brahman sprang from the Brahmana sprang from Brahman's mouth, as he was the firstborn, and he possesses the Veda, he is by right the Lord of this whole creation. For the self-existent Swayambhu, having performed austerities, produced him first from his own mouth, in order that the offerings must be conveyed to the gods and manes, and that this universe might be preserved. That created being can surpass him, through whose mouth the gods continually consume the sacrificial offerings and the manes the offerings to the dead. Of created beings, the most excellent are said to be those which are animated, of the animated, those which subsist of intelligence, of the intelligent, mankind of man and the Brahmanas, and of men the Brahmanas. Means it's just like the essence. Means the intelligence of the intelligent. Means, in other words, is Krishna. Of Brahmanas, those learned in the Veda, of those learned who recognize the necessity in the manner of performing the prescribed duties, of those who possess this knowledge, those who perform them, and of performers, those who know the Brahman. So this is a very important point, is that someone may know the Veda, but better than someone who knows the Veda is someone knows how to apply it, how to perform the prescribed activities. Better than that is who has that knowledge than those who actually do it. I may have the theory, But unless I do it, it's not that good. Somebody knows the Veda doesn't know that it means anything. So those who know how to apply it, theoretically, are better than that. Those who know how to practically apply it are better than that. And one who knows that this is all meant for the pleasure of the Supreme Lord, or knows the Supreme Lord, they are the best. Right? So in other words, this is Bhrigu's description. So when we discuss all these different activities of the living entities, what they should do, then we should understand that we're discussing the theory, but then practicing it, but knowing it in relationship to the Lord, that is actual. That is the best. That is the Vaishnava. Brahman is one, he's learned the Veda. He knows how to, it means he gets, he's Dvija. He learns the Veda, he becomes Vipra. Better Vipra is one who knows how to apply it. Better Vipra than that is one who actually applies it. But then the next category is the Vaishnava. He sees it in relationship to the Lord. So the devotee, the Vaishnava, is the best of the Brahmanas. So this is very important when we discuss the activities. We have to understand that the devotee has the realization and the consciousness and understanding of the Brahmana, who is realized, who is a devotee. So therefore, when we deal with the aspects of Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra, and Grihastha, Brahmachari, Vanaprastha, Nyas, this is only in relationship to the conditioned nature that the body and mind and intelligence have, the ego. It actually has nothing to do with the soul. So the soul is already understands, is the realization. So the soul is now awakened and is acting as we are acting on the platform of Vaishnava. But because the conditioned nature is there, as we discussed in the beginning, about karma, jnana, yoga, that must be engaged in Krishna's service. So the body has been produced by the Lord, you know, in a sequence of events, and he is given a sequence of activities that the living entity should follow. So the body, the mind, intelligence must be run through those activities. The brahmachari must do the brahmachari activities, the grihastha must do those. But all of them are the topmost platform of Brahman or a Vaishnava. So even though a devotee may perform brahminical occupational duties, kshatriya occupational duties, vaishya or shudra occupational duties, they are not a brahman, kshatriya, vaishya, shudra. They're all the topmost brahman or vaishnava. Those activities are just how to engage the particular kind of body and mind we happen to have in this birth. Like that. That we find that this is the body we're in, we have to engage this. So therefore, we follow like this. So that becomes, that's a very essential point. It means we do not identify ourselves as these varnas and ashrams. Naham vipro na cha narapatir napi vaishya na shudro. Naham varani na cha grihapatir no vanastoya tirva. We're none of these. Right? What are we? Kintu prodyan nikila paramananda purnamritabdher gopi bartu parakamalayor das das anudas. We are the servant of the servant of the servant, thousand times removed servant, of Krishna, who is the Lord of the Gopis. That's who we are. But because my body has the nature and the habit to act in a particular way, I gauge it in that way for Krishna. Why I should do otherwise? Arjuna says, I'll go to the forest, be a Brahmin. Krishna says, no. You have the nature of a Kshatriya. You do that for me. He's going to be pleased that Arjuna acts as a Kshatriya and offers that service to Krishna. And he's going to be pleased with others that they offer whatever they have, their activities, their intelligence, according to their conditioned nature. So that is there. That is our service that we do. But it is not, that is just what activities we do. But devotees, the equality is there because of their understanding, realization. So therefore, the real way that we see higher and lower in the Vaishnava community is advancement in spiritual knowledge, jnana and vairag, and devotion. You know, we see the kanista, the madhyam, the uttam. like that. And for social structure, the varnashram is there. We respect the different varnas and different orders and all that. But that's just to create the social structure. The real respect is on degree of a spiritual advancement. The very birth of a Brahman is an eternal incarnation of the sacred law, for he is born to fulfill the sacred law and becomes one with Brahman. This means one who is qualified. This doesn't not mean one who is born in a Brahmin family, but one who has a Brahminical character. A Brahmin coming into existence is born as the highest on earth, the lord of all created beings, for the protection of the treasury of the law, because first birth is always animal birth. Then, after that, one takes one's birth as a Brahmin with initiation. Whatever exists in the world is the property of the Brahmana. On account of the excellence of his origin, the Brahmana is indeed entitled to it all. The Brahmana eats but his own food, wears but his own apparel, bestows but his own in alms. Other mortals subsist through the benevolence of the Brahmanas. In other words, since it all belongs to them, they go out and beg alms of what you're giving them, who's already theirs to begin with. You give them cloth, it's already theirs to begin with. Because the Lord has given everything to the Brahmins. But out of the benevolence, the Brahmins don't need it, don't desire it. So they give it for everybody else. You use it. It's your, you keep it. In order to clearly settle his duties and those of the other castes according to their order, wise Manu sprung from the self-existent composed these institutes of sacred law. A learned Brahmana must carefully study them, and he must duly instruct his pupils in them, but nobody else shall do it. Because otherwise what happens is others instruct, they may instruct from a different angle, for the purpose of controlling the people, for the purpose of getting profit for them, or just for turning everything upside down so I just get what I want. Like that. Because the Brahman is supposed to be detached. So therefore, he can teach. Others won't teach. Maybe by example, but they don't specifically teach. The teaching is specific for the Brahmins because he will teach according to the benefit of the student, not for his own benefit. Because everything belongs to him anyway, but he doesn't want it. He's given away. He lives simply. Like that. So they're not like a beggar. Beggar has nothing, wants everything, but all he can get is a little bit of paisa here and there. The Brahmin has everything, but wants nothing. Therefore, he's given it to everybody else. So he's just coming, and it's just his duty to be humble in that, to come and beg and live simply in this way. Brahmin who studies these institutes faithfully fulfills the duties prescribed therein and is never tainted by sins arising from thoughts, words, or deeds. He sanctifies any company which he may enter, seven ancestors and seven descendants, and he alone deserves to possess the whole earth. To study this work is the best means of securing welfare. It increases understanding. It procures fame and long life. It leads to supreme bliss. Means it leads to the transcendental understanding. So we see that this Brahman that we're talking about can't be a materialistic Brahman, but one who knows Brahman, actually. So that means the devotee. So when it's talking here, that means everything belongs to the devotees. The devotees are the ones who this all belongs to. In this world, in this work, the sacred law has been fully stated, as well as the good and the bad qualities of human actions, and the immemorial rule of conduct, to be followed by all four varnas and ashrams. The rule of conduct is transcendent law, whether it be taught in the revealed text or in this sacred tradition. Hence a twice-born man who possesses regard for himself should be always careful to follow it. A Brahman who departs from the rule of conduct does not reap the fruit of the Vedas, but he who duly follows it will obtain the full reward. So the real fruit is the spiritual understanding, as we mentioned. Should always be kept in mind. See, this scripture is written for everybody. Now, the person interested in transcendence understands this is God's law. So by following, you please the Lord. Because Krishna says in Gita, perform your prescribed duties. Now, there are those who are not interested in the supreme goal. They don't want to go back to Godhead. But this, everybody's on Krishna's path, so they just take part of it. So then some want the fruits, heavenly fruits, some want all different kinds of fruits. Here he mentioned here, different kinds of fruits. To study this work is the best means of securing welfare. It increases understanding, you know, your intelligence, your gyan. It procures fame and long life. So here, best means of securing welfare, you know, means your, economic development, right? Very dear to the Vaishyas. It increases understanding, very dear to the Brahmins, right? It produces fame and long life, right? That very dear to the Kshatriyas and long life to the Shudras. It leads to supreme bliss, what is desired by the Vaishnavas, right? So, depending upon how you use this tool, this apara vidya, you can get any one of these. So therefore, it'll refer many times to seemingly material benefits, because there are those who are not interested in attaining the supreme bliss or the happiness of relationship with the Lord. Bliss can only be happen if there's relationship. Ananda is only with relationship. So that means and that can only happen in relationship to the Lord. So that supreme bliss can only be situating oneself in the spiritual realm. So by following the process of prescribed duties for Krishna's pleasure, without attachment, you know, understanding we're not the doer, this then can bring us to that platform. And if we don't want to go to that platform, yeah, we can get to the heavenly planets, we can live a long life, we can get wealthy, all these things will come, either this life, next life, whatever. But that is avidya, because it keeps us in the material world. So when we use this scripture for that, dharma, artha, and kama, then it is avidya. And if we're using it for even moksha, because it mentions intelligence. So those. But if it goes for the higher, for spiritual understanding, then it becomes perfect. It becomes apara avidya. It helps us get out of the material world. Yeah. So those who follow will obtain the full reward. The full reward is Krishna consciousness. But the point is that others will take full reward as going to the heavenly planets, going to here and there. The sages who saw that the sacred law is thus grounded on the rule of conduct have taken good contact to be the most excellent root of all austerity. So here's a very important point, is that the culture is based on proper conduct. Right? So proper conduct is the basis of all of our austerities. Whatever we're doing, that has to be the element. By our austerities, we become rough, we become nasty, we become proud, we become dry. Then that is not actual austerity, because it's not based on good conduct. If we become more and more gentle, more properly behaved, more considerate of others, that is real austerity. Then what we're doing is proper. And if it's not, then we're not. But this means actual. This doesn't mean feigned. It doesn't mean some New Age philosophy of just being nice to everybody. This means actual, you are nice to others because you see them as individual souls who are coming from Krishna. And it behooves us to behave properly with them. So that's coming from understanding. The creation of the universe, the rules of the sacraments, the ordinances of studentship, and the respectful behavior towards gurus, the most excellent rule of bathing on return from the teacher's house. That's an excellent rule of bathing. This means snatak, means graduation. I mentioned before the guru, the ashram, he washes the feet the graduate, and there's this water that he sprinkles himself with this water, because now the water will be his protector. And water is the source of rasa, or the source of relationship. So then the ultimate means we're taking shelter of the Lord. The law of marriage and the description of the various marriage rites, the regulations for the great sacrifices, and the eternal rule of the funeral sacrifices. The descriptions of the modes of gaining subsistence and the duties of snataka. The rules regarding lawful and forbidden food, the purification of men and things. The laws concerning women, the law of hermits, the law of gaining final emancipation and of renouncing the world. The whole duty of a king and the main manner of deciding lawsuits. The rules for the examination of witnesses, the laws concerning husband and wife, the law of inheritance and division, the law concerning gambling and the removal of men, noxious like thorns. The law concerning the behavior of Vaishyas and Shudras, the origin of the mixed castes, the law for all Varnas in times of distress, and the law of penances. All varnas in times of distress, so practical things. Maybe you can't do your occupations of your varna due to just things being too crazy. So it's very practical. The threefold course of transmigrations, the result of good or bad actions, the manner of attaining supreme bliss, and the examination of the good and bad qualities of actions. The primeval laws of countries, standing of families, and the rules concerning heretics and companies of traders and the like, that all Manu has described in these institutions. As Manu, in reply to my questions, formally promulgated these institutes, even so learn ye also the work from me, the whole work from me. So that was describing what is going to be described here, from the Brahmachari through the Grihastha, then what are all the different things, what things are things you can eat, not eat, all the different laws, how the king governs, how he deals with the lawsuits, how he removes people who are improperly behaved, and then how to reinstate oneself in transcendental, transcendental life. All this is described by Manu. And now Bhrigu says, then he now is going to speak it. It's really amazing, right? Krishna taught it to Brahma. Brahma opens the chapter. Then he turns the discussion over to Bhrigu. And now Bhrigu will speak the rest. Like that. So one must appreciate the literary excellence of Vyasadeva when he writes all these things. Very excellent how he puts them all together. So that ends the first chapter, which then shows the creation and that and all the different aspects within it, because all those aspects will be discussed, because different things will send you to all these different places. Unless you understand the creation, then you won't understand the laws of Manu, because then these laws are going to give you they're dealing with action and reaction. And you do a particular activity that will take you to a particular place. In other words, creates a particular mentality. As he said, all the living entities have a particular mentality. So because of that, they're placed. So if you do a particular activity, that develops that particular mentality, which will, by fruit of the result of the activity, will send you to that particular place or that particular body. So it's all, in other words, basically what's happening is just the mind is reacting with the material energy. So one has to control the mind by the intelligence and by the spiritual understanding, then one acts properly. Any questions on this? Yes, Martin.
Well, this is summarized, but usually when we speak about prescribed duties, we're talking about Navratana, Bhagavatam. When usually as Vaishnavas, when we speak about prescribed duties, we talk about Navratana, Bhagavatam, things like that. So I'm just very interested to get a clearer idea of why you want to study math and research.
Because this is where they're all coming from. Those laws are there. Like Prabhupada says, you know, see throughout the Bhagavatam, he is discussing the what a grihastha does. Those are all coming from here. So the Bhagavatam is full of those. Means you see, Prithu Maharaj acts as a perfect king. Those have all come from here. He's acting according to the laws given by Krishna. And he's showing perfectly how to engage that in Krishna's service. So the reason that we come to this is simply because we find that devotees don't know how to act. And they don't know how to perform, they don't know how to act as a brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas. They don't know how to act as a brahman, kshatriya, vaishya, shudra. And they're always talking about economic development, social development, which is all the purpose of the scripture. Means you're interested in dharma, artha, kama, moksha. This is the scripture. Like that. If you're interested in going back to Godhead, then you have to engage those things in the Lord's service. And if you don't, then here. So, and many of them think that they're going to benefit economically by following other processes than the Lord's law. So just to show that all these things, and many will say that the Vedic things and what the Bhagavatam's talking about, all this doesn't apply in this age. But as we see here, it was described by Brahma that at any age, it's the same. Krishna's created it. It doesn't matter which universal manifestation it was, which day of Brahma it was, which day of the demigods, or which day of the manus, or which day of the humans it is. The law of God still applies. So we're just basically trying to give faith. From here, we're just trying to give faith that one follows the teachings of the Bhagavatam. Because sometimes devotees think they're just some obscure things, you know, just somehow or another, and the purport probably just rambled on and just said it, you know, why he said it, who knows, you know. But many feel it's not practical or this or that. So the idea was basically to give a clear picture of that, like that. And then we can see as we go through that Prabhupada discusses all these things. There's nothing more. Another aspect is to remove the mystique that there's some big ocean of stuff. It's not very much at all, especially just what we deal with. We're not even dealing with how the king manages the kingdom and all the laws and this and that. That's half the book. So half the book is just for the individual and how they perform their duties and relate to others. You know, as a, you know, brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, something like this. Like that, and the basic duties, doesn't get into the details of the king and the overall social. So that's mainly what we were thinking to deal with. And we read this through, you know, very carefully, just to show that one can see that the description here is basically the same as in the Bhagavatam. So the Vedic literatures, all the Vedic literatures basically say the same thing. But they don't necessarily bring to the front very strongly the purpose of pure God consciousness. So the Manu Samhita we can see here, up to now, at least three times it's been mentioned that that's the purpose. All these activities are for understanding Brahman, for understanding the Supreme Lord. But when he gets into discussing it, that's not always brought to the front. He just says, grihastha does this, grihastha does that, this gets that, that gets that. If you do like this, things will be nice. If you don't do like this, it won't be nice. So one can tend to forget, because you'll generally find most people, if they wanted to study Manu Samhita, the first thing they would do would be to avoid the first chapter. You know? And the next chapter is the sources of the law, where the laws come from. They'll remove that. They'll just go straight in and look at what do they say about shooters? What do they say about this? And then you think, wow, this is crazy. It has nothing to do with us. That's why the rule is you have to start reading a shastra from the beginning and go to the end, because the beginning is all, in any shastra, is always the Krishna conscious part. And then later it gets into the specific application of what it's doing. Like the Ayurveda starts the same way. It's all creation and philosophy. Then it gets into just how to deal with medicine. Like that. So that aspect is there. So this is... So we want to show that it's the prescribed duties that are talked about are valuable for us. Means if we are not going to just work on the platform of sadhana bhakti, and we want to expand out and get very serious about our grihastha ashram and independence and making some good money and facility and protecting ourselves and putting money away from the future, because you know money naturally, how you say, money is security, you know, land, buildings, they're all secure, right? They protect one, isn't it? Isn't that the whole idea? We get married because of the protection, the security. Right? Isn't that? So then at least we should know what we're dealing with. If we want to drop down to the level of work for Krishna, then at least we should understand what that means. Otherwise, we should just stick to the platform of sadhana bhakti and just, you know, deal in the platform of nishkam karma yoga fully. You know? On the platform of sadhana. And not even hardly touching the working for Krishna. The sadhana already is working for Krishna, but it doesn't get very deep into the varnas and ashrams. It just touches on them, just enough to create a form of social dealings. But if we want to go deeper, then we should know what we're dealing with. Otherwise, it's only speculation. So that was the idea, like that. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Prabhupada also says in the fourth chapter in the Bhagavad Gita at the start that the leaders of society should be conversant with his Dharma Shastras, especially the Manu Samhita. In 4.1, I think, or 4.2.
Oh, really? Bhagavad Gita. Yeah, because the thing here, it says only the Brahmin should know this. So then that's basically the purpose of the discussion, is to understand what is going on. They should teach it like that. And then, so then it's understood, and then you can advise others. Because in the preacher, when they are preaching, not everyone's going to be on the platform of very deep surrender. And they may need to. They may be congregation, they may be this, that. They have. So they want to know how to properly perform life as a congregational member, you know, doing their job, living with their family, doing all these things, so they want to know what would be the proper thing, like that. So then here it is you just get everything in one place. So on that we're studying, like that, for that purpose. It's part of the preaching. One ourselves, we'll find there's here many nice things that we ourselves can follow, and at the same time is then it gives a lot of information how to train others. Is that understood? Like that. We have to see it where its place is in the devotional process. The difficulty is devotees don't study deeply enough to understand this. Like, you know, Krishna, there's two chapters in Gita just called Karma Yoga. But if you start talking about Karma Yoga, devotees will think that it's nothing to do with Krishna consciousness. Even though two chapters of Gita are specifically geared to it, but actually more are dealing with it. They just say, "Oh, that's something else." They just don't. They haven't studied where they understand that this is part of the process. You know. But the point is it has to be brought in line with how the Acharya speaks. Then it has some meaning. You know. Prabhupada gave us so much of this. You know. But like it says here, the marriage rites. Like that. The law of marriage and the description of the various marriage rites. You know? So, Prabhupada has discussed all that, but devotees tend to forget. So like that, then we try to remember that and see it in that light, how Prabhupada will present it. So, you have to forgive us if we fall exceedingly short of that desired goal, but whatever. It's winter time and a little hot air can be useful. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.